The following program is a PBS Wisconsin original production.
With revised respect for marriage,
the Respect for Marriage Act clears its final hurdles in Congress, and federal recognition of same-sex marriage heads to the president's desk. And in Wisconsin, Democrats and Republicans gear up for 2023 and what to do with an historic budget surplus. I'm Frederica Freiberg. Tonight on Here and Now, we return to Nelsonville to investigate where nitrate contamination is coming from and hear from the DNR about its role in water regulation. Research analyst Jason Stein on what he calls an astounding budget surplus and state party leadership foreshadow priorities for the coming year. It's Here and Now for December 9.
Funding for Here and Now is provided by the Focus Fund for Journalism and Friends of PBS Wisconsin.
On this program last week, we heard from a village whose private well water is contaminated with nitrate. This week, Here and Now reporter Nathan Denzine takes us back to Nelsonville to find out where the nitrate is coming from and what residents can do about their contaminated water.
It doesn't taste any different. It doesn't look any different. There's no smell to it. It tastes great.
But what Terrion O'Carroll found out was his family's private well water had unsafe nitrate levels, a problem residents in the small village of Nelsonville in Portage County learned about back in 2018. The two contributors under the microscope, manure from farm animals or septic systems that leak human waste. Portage County water resource specialist Jen McNally says scientific water testing showed nitrates are largely coming from agriculture.
There's some role that septic systems are playing, but probably not, by and large, the largest contributing source of it.
Enter Gordondale Farms, a concentrated animal feeding operation, or CAFO, of about 1,200 cows and 5,000 acres just outside of Nelsonville. Its owner, Kyle Gordon, and his family have been farming this land near Nelsonville since 1900.
Well, I think we have to be really careful when we talk about the science shows. We would really like to see more research on that. They seem to have dismissed septic.
Gordon says he does accept farming can impact drinking water, but he's not convinced his own farm is.
Our take on the nitrates from our standpoint is our farm has always had a nutrient management plan since 1981. We followed every regulation that's been put forth to us. So to be honest, it's quite a puzzle. Like, where is it coming from? Like, what is the deal?
By all accounts, Gordondale Farms has followed every DNR nitrate regulation and in recent years gone further. In most plots near the village, Gordon says his farm now plants alfalfa or Italian ryegrass, which soak up more nitrate in soil than corn. County water officials say despite Gordon's efforts and abiding by nitrate regulations, agriculture remains the likely culprit, at least in part because DNR rules don't account for the sandy soils in the region. Also, water flow itself affects what kind of waste, agricultural or septic, is ending up in wells. Pete Arnstead is a hydrologist for a regional environmental group.
Because of the hydrogeology, that water from the septic system passes above all the wells and discharges to the Tamar River and really isn't the issue.
Because wells draw from groundwater, contamination can come from miles away and take years to end up in the drinking water. Agricultural practices like the ones Gordon has turned to can reduce the nitrates in private wells. But according to scientist George Kraft, that can also take years, even decades.
I think, you know, we'd be almost out of the woods, you know, so significantly in 8-10 years and maybe mostly or entirely in 2025.
In August, the DNR told Gordondale Farms it had to install 3 monitoring wells on its property. Gordon is fighting that in court. For its part, the village also hopes to use $250,000 in federal funds to install its own monitoring wells. And so fights over the monitoring wells and who's at fault for the contamination is fracturing the community.
I would say that a lot of people are angry.
Lisa Anderson is a clean water advocate who lives in Nelsonville.
We've been accused of having an agenda. We've been targeted on social media.
Tempers are definitely high.
I'm sure everyone knows what the finger is, right? We either get a plugged nose or we get a finger. The sad part, we're busy fighting each other. I understand clean water is everyone's right, but if you're going to live out here in paradise, it's your responsibility to take care of your well and take care of your septic system.
To spend $10,000 on a well for most of us is a major expense, and many can't afford it. And I think many of us feel like, why should we have to?
Gordon also says he can't afford the monitoring wells he's ordered to dig, and it could put him out of business. Village residents say they don't want that. They just want clean water.
I'm not anti-ag. We'll just get that out of the way. It's not the farmer at all. They're working as hard as they can to make a good living, and that's fair.
Still, residents say the state should impose new regulations for the Central Sands region to protect the groundwater.
The rules are the problem. So, the DNR needs to step up and fix this issue, in my mind.
For Here and Now, I'm Nathan Denzine in Nelsonville.
A decision whether Gordon should pay for construction of monitoring wells on his property is expected in court over the next few months. As we just heard, some private well owners in Nelsonville say the rules are the problem and call on the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources for help in addressing nitrate contamination there and across the state. What has been done to help and what more remediation is in the offing? We turn to Jim Zelmer, Deputy Administrator in the DNR's Environmental Management Division, and thanks very much for being here.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for having me.
So we know that the update to the DNR rules for water quality that were to address nitrates in areas susceptible to groundwater contamination did not happen. Yet that is what concerned people in places like Nelsonville are calling for. What can you tell them?
Sure. As you mentioned, we had started the rulemaking a couple of years back and brought stakeholders together to try to establish targeted performance standards for areas that are susceptible to groundwater contamination. Unfortunately, we ran out of time. We have a 30-month window by law to complete our rulemaking, and we just could not reach consensus with all of our stakeholders to move that rule forward. So we stopped that rulemaking. We continue the discussions, working with our stakeholders on making progress, really that for that shared goal of reducing nitrate contamination to the groundwater.
Has that worked, working through it, even in the absence of the enactment of those updated rules?
Yeah, we continue to work with our stakeholders, and we have been very impressed. Obviously, we work with our sister agency, Department of Ag, also with the University of Wisconsin, on really providing the agribusiness with the tools that they need to properly manage to apply their fertilizer, be it either in commercial purchase fertilizer or manure, to make the maximum use of it, make it available for the crops, but not to result in leaching to the groundwater. And we've seen some very good success our Department of Ag has producer-led watershed groups across the state. We have well over 40 of these groups that are, this is really farmers talking to farmers, learning from each other what works, what doesn't. So we're seeing some good success with that.
Would it be important, though, in your mind, to have those updated rules to make sure that we attain and maintain clean drinking water? Or are we okay where we are with the status quo?
Yeah, we continue to evaluate that. We're working, like I said, right now with our partners to further that initiative. Also, specifically to, up in the Nelsonville area where your report has been focused on, we're just in early stages of working with the Portage County Land and Water Conservation Department to develop a geographic plan for the watershed to look at the causes. We know, you know, we know some of the causes of the nitrate contamination, and then look at what practices can be put in place to address those problems. In that plan will be milestones, and then also a checking back and reporting to see what's working, what's not, and then moving forward to, you know, find proven technologies that we can, again, work together to reduce the nitrate contamination.
Yeah, because given that experts declare nitrate contamination from ag sources is Wisconsin's most common groundwater contaminant, are CAFOs or these concentrated animal feeding operations getting new scrutiny?
They continue to get scrutiny. They have been heavily scrutinized, and they continue to be scrutinized. We're very encouraged by a number of the CAFOs. Now, I believe we have 8 of the CAFOs that are working on wastewater treatment facilities for their operation. We also have a new organic biodigester that has been put in operation in Brown County that I believe brings in manure from 14 area nearby farmers that they then, you know, they treat the manure, and then they generate gas that is put into our natural gas piping so we can use it to heat our homes. Also, they concentrate the nitrogen, use it again for fertilizer, and then the solids can be used for bedding and other purposes on the farm. So again, very encouraging, some of the things that are going on.
For people suffering with contaminated wells right now, I know there's a new well compensation and abandonment program funded with $10 million in ARPA money. How far will that go, and how can people access that program?
Yeah, very good. Thank you for that question. So as you had said, Governor Evers allotted $10 million to expand that well compensation program that can be used for obviously drilling a new well deeper to find a safe source of water, installing treatment, or connecting to a nearby, either another private well or a public water supply. So we really encourage folks. So far we've there's enough money there to fund in excess of 1,600 well replacements. So far, we've only had 40 applicants. So we really encourage people that are experiencing problems with their private wells that they contact us. They can go on our website just at dnr.wi.gov. Just type in well comp. And the first thing that comes up will be this ARPA well compensation program. It talks about eligibility, application process, pretty easy to fill out, and we really encourage people to use that program.
Good info. Jim Zellmer, DNR, thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Wisconsin is in the best financial situation in the history of the state, according to state officials. We're talking about a projected $6.5 billion state budget surplus. That's $6.5 billion with a B. In this Fast Facts report, Here and Now reporter Stephen Potter explores how the state checking account ended up so far in the black and what might affect the state's finances going forward.
Windfall is because the state will end the current fiscal year in July with more money than state agencies were allocated for their needs. Imagine it like your own household budget. You plan for the bills you have and make a schedule to pay them when they're due. But then you get a surprise, a hefty lump sum payment right after you pay those bills. In the state's case, that's $6.5 billion. Analysts say the reason state coffers are overflowing is primarily due to three factors. There's been an influx of federal funds from COVID relief bills that have offset state costs for expenses such as Medicaid. Also, elected leaders have kept tight control over state agency spending. And there's been a considerable increase in tax revenue, including not only sales tax, but also investment and corporate taxes. Of course, inflation is playing a major part of this ballooning budget surplus. The more people spend, the more taxes are collected. Officials warn, however, that the full projected surplus is not guaranteed, and the end amount may be smaller. Factors affecting that include a possible recession next year, as well as economic disruptions with the ongoing war in Ukraine. Volatility of business and the stock market could also lead to less corporate and investment taxes being taken in.
2010-11, there was a $3.6 billion deficit.
This state budget surplus is in stark contrast to years past, when elected leaders faced hundreds of millions of dollars in budget shortfalls and structural deficits. Regardless of exactly how much extra surplus the state ends up having, we can be sure of one thing. The state's elected leaders will find numerous ways to argue over how to spend it. For Here and Now, I'm Stephen Potter.
In a new report titled The Astounding State Surplus, the Wisconsin Policy Forum research director says the projections of a $6.5 billion surplus are useful, but far from certain. We check in now with Jason Stein for more on the implications for state spending and taxing. And Jason, nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
So you've covered and researched Wisconsin state budgets for a while. As you saw these projections grow, did it surprise you?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, when we think about 2 years ago when we were at this point, things did not really look that good for the state. But then we had two very large federal pieces of legislation, the Consolidated Appropriations Act and then the American Rescue Plan Act, that really juiced the economy. They shot state tax collections upward. And despite inflation, the state really hasn't spent a ton of that money. And so that we find ourselves here with this really remarkable surplus.
Here we are, the astounding surplus. So we detailed, and you just expressed some of the reasons that the state coffers are so fat, like those COVID funds and an increase in sales tax revenue. But what kind of choices then do legislative budget writers make with this money?
Well, I mean, they really have an unprecedented level of choice. I mean, clearly you've seen the governor and lawmakers talk about some sort of tax cuts. Both the personal property tax is something that's been mentioned, as well as income tax cuts. So, I mean, I would stay tuned for both of those things. And then we have had a world where it's 8% inflation, and yet local governments and schools have seen fairly tight limits on their state and local funding. Now, they've gotten federal pandemic funding, but it's also running out. And so I think, you know, one key question is, does the state try and look at some of those issues at the local level and try and step in and assist the local officials?
Well, for sure, we know that municipalities have been crying out for more shared revenue. Would now be the time, perhaps, both with one-time and more sustainable funding going forward?
I mean, right. So, there's always options that state officials have. One thing that local officials have sought is the ability to levy their own sales tax, so cities and villages to be able to do that. The legislature, at least Republicans in the legislature, has been pretty reluctant to take that on. And so to them, increasing state aid to municipalities may seem like a compromised position. I mean, when we talk about the multi-billion dollar surplus we have, you know, in year one of the budget, increasing shared revenue by even 10% would be something like $80 million and $160 million in year two. So these are, I mean, in a normal world, that's a lot of money.
Right.
But it, you know, in the present circumstance, it's not as much as it typically would be.
They've also asked for, again, this kind of sustainable funding mechanism, and that would be like the local sales tax.
Right. And, you know, I mean, the state would have the option of even lawmakers who are concerned about raising taxes could combine a local sales tax with, you know, say, income tax cuts at the state level and leave taxpayers, at least in the state as a whole, better off or paying lower taxes. But of course, you know, a sales tax is going to have more impact on people at the lower end of the income scale. It's more regressive. So, you know, there'll be a lot of discussion about that, I think.
Stepping back a little bit, what do you regard as the biggest need areas?
Oh, it's a great question. Again, schools have been at their state and local revenue limits have been frozen for 2 years. And so that's something that and their federal pandemic aid is running out. So that's a major issue. You see in terms of public safety, you see actually cities and villages going to referendum asking voters to approve raising their own property taxes to pay for public safety. And you see in some communities that happened in November, which is pretty new. You see school referenda for many years, but not the level of other local government referenda. So, I mean, those are two things that step out, but we also have higher education. We have turnover within state and local governments, and then we have infrastructure needs as well. So.
We need a lot of money to do a lot of things, as always, in a state budget. But as we have pointed out, it is not likely to be smooth sailing between the governor and the Republican budget riders, for example, on things like Medicaid expansion or, as we've discussed, school funding.
Yeah, absolutely. And so one thing to understand is, you know, Medicaid, which is the second biggest expense for the state, health care, you know, just to keep current services the same would be about $750 million over the next 2 years. At the same time, you know, there is this opportunity to expand the program and pull in additional federal money through the Federal Affordable Care Act and through the American Rescue Plan Act, like $1.5 billion over 2 years. So, you know, that's something that the Republicans have turned down in the past. But I think there's also an unprecedented opportunity for horse trading in this budget. So, you know, even though you wouldn't expect that to be on the table, perhaps it might.
I doubt it. But Jason Stein, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Democrats in the Wisconsin legislature will head into the next session with even smaller minorities. But the leaders of the party in the Senate and Assembly say they still represent the majority of the state. Here and Now senior political reporter Zach Schultz recently sat down with Senator Melissa Agard and Representative Greta Neubauer and has this story.
Senator Melissa Agard is still getting used to her new office and her new position as the Democratic minority leader.
It feels a bit like drinking from the fire hose, but also I'm really ready.
With only 11 members, the Democrats are powerless to pass legislation. But Agard points to the statewide win by Governor Tony Evers to show Democrats represent the values of the majority of Wisconsin.
Ultimately, we may hold the minority of seats in the state of Wisconsin, but we know that we hold the majority of the hearts of the people of the state of Wisconsin and the work that we are doing.
Democrats blame gerrymandered redistricting maps for their minority status. Representative Greta Neubauer is the minority leader for the Democrats in the Assembly and says it was a challenge just to find candidates willing to run in some districts.
It was a real challenge to run for office. We are in incredibly polarized partisan times, and it was hard to both recruit people to run, particularly women, because they knew that they and their family may face threats. And that, unfortunately, did bear out this cycle for candidates, for volunteers.
Assembly Democrats won 35 seats, just enough to prevent a Republican supermajority that would allow the GOP to override any of Evers' vetoes. But if two members are missing, the GOP would have enough.
Our caucus understands that one of our top priorities for the session is being here in Madison to make sure that if Republicans are trying to override Governor Evers' vetoes and move our state backwards, we're here to protect those vetoes.
Neubauer took over as leader partway through the last session, so this will be her first full term in charge. And she and Agard understand Democrats in the minority need to be more than the party of no.
We know that a lot of people are frustrated with politics right now, and I think our responsibility is to pass policy in the Capitol that makes people's lives better and shows that government can and must be a force for good.
They hope the budget will create some spaces for compromise on things like increasing shared revenue.
Supporting our local governments, I think, is at the top of the pile of things that we can agree on. It's whether, you know, so we have the endpoint, how it is that we get there, what are the paths that we use to move forward, to be continued.
Agard also hopes to break the impasse in the Senate over confirming Governor Evers' appointees. Over the past 4 years, Republicans have refused to hold final votes on some Evers' selections for his cabinet and important governing bodies like the Natural Resources Board.
Based on what I'm hearing from my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, they're ready to start moving forward with them. Let's have the tough conversations at the committee level. Let's bring it to the floor. Let's debate it. And let's vote up or down. If the governor needs to go back to work, if the majority party does feel like that person is not the right fit, holding them in this weird limbo isn't going to help the state of Wisconsin.
But there is one area where Democrats are not looking for common ground: abortion.
There are some issues where there is no room for compromise. This is a personal health care decision. It is not a place where politicians belong. And some of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle have suggested that we also include in the doctor's office not just politicians, but police officers.
Republicans have talked about passing a bill that would modify the 1849 law banning abortions to provide exceptions for rape or incest.
As one of the roughly 50% of people in Wisconsin who lost a concrete right in the last year, I know how important it is and have heard from people across the state about how important it is that we keep fighting for really comprehensive access to reproductive health care. Exceptions are not comprehensive, and we know that.
Democrats would rather keep the current law in place while they wait for legal challenges to make it to the Supreme Court, which leads to the other priority for Democrats, electing a liberal to the Supreme Court in April.
We are going to be actively engaged in making sure that we elect a justice who is willing to put the people of Wisconsin over their party.
A liberal majority on the court could write new legislative maps in Wisconsin, giving Democrats a chance to win more seats and hold more sway at the Capitol.
Not only is it tied to redistricting, abortion rights, union rights, the list goes on and on.
Reporting from Madison, I'm Zach Schultz for Here and Now.
Next week, we hear from Republican Senate Majority Leader Devin Lemieux. And coming up, look for Zach's one-on-one with Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, variably known as the most powerful voice in the legislature. And for more on this and other issues facing Wisconsin, visit our website at pbswisconsin.org and then click on the News tab. That's our program for tonight. I'm Frederica Freiberg. Have a good weekend.
Funding for Here and Now is provided by the Focus Fund for Journalism and Friends of PBS Wisconsin.